The Guardian.
Can you tell me a bit about what happened and how you ended up with this really terrible injury?
So about 7 years ago, I was living out in Montana, working as a cook, and I was just sitting around the house. One of my roommates invited me to go mountain biking with him, pretty standard thing. And then he got a flat tire, and I continued on while he was walking down a different route. And I came up to a jump that I had never gone over before. I usually rode around it. This is a pretty familiar trail, and I sort of never really decided if I was going to hit it or not, and ended up just kind of rolling over it and hitting the other side of the jump pretty badly, and landed on my head and broke two bones in my neck, and first realized I couldn't breathe normally, and then I was laying face down in the dirt and realized my arms weren't working right and I couldn't feel my legs at all.
That's Jeff Markey from Wisconsin in the US. He's a participant in a groundbreaking bit of research at the Kentucky Spinal Cord Research Center.
They've been told this is never going to happen again, and they are right there showing you that this is possible.
This week, we're looking into this trial, which gave four participants who were unable to move their legs the ability to regain some control, and in some cases, like Jeff, walk again. You're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Nicola Davis. We'll hear more from Jeff Markey and the researcher he worked with later, but first, I wanted to get a lay of the land about spinal cord injuries. Producer Jeff Marsh went to meet Simone Di Giovanni, a neurologist at Imperial College London, for a sit-down in his office.
Spinal cord is particularly vulnerable because it's only protected by some bones in the back. And the injury to the spinal cord itself is most often due to the displacement of the fractured bone into the spinal cord. Therefore, the brain and the muscles do not communicate anymore because the highway, which is the spinal cord, is interrupted.
So everything below the site of injury loses its movement?
Correct. Movement, but always is also sensory functions are always impaired. So feeling, touching. And not only that, what is very important, there are also a number of so-called autonomic functions, meaning the control of blood pressure, control of gut motility, urinary function, they're also impaired. And this is really bad for the quality of life of patients.
How many people are affected by spinal cord injuries?
About 300,000 in the US, about 60,000 in the UK, similar number in Europe compared to the US. Numbers are much more hard to gather in other countries, but at least these are the numbers in some of the Western countries.
So it's not trivial numbers, but also very devastating kind of condition.
Yeah, it's not trivial numbers, and it is, you touched upon an important point, because although it's not trivial numbers, it's much less than Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease. However, spinal cord injury affects largely young people, and therefore the burden for them psychologically is immense for their families and financially also for the society. You need to take care and support these people, you know, for many, many years to come.
So, you know, when someone breaks a bone, they go into hospital, they get x-rayed and they get wrapped up in a cast. Time does its thing and, you know, they can walk again or their arm works again. What is the problem with the spinal cord? Why is this not the case with the spinal cord?
The spinal cord, similarly to the brain, do not have the spontaneous capacity to repair and to regenerate. In other words, the broken nerves cannot reconnect. And the reconnectivity of this interrupted circuitry, wiring, if you will, is essential for recovery. And that does just not happen spontaneously. There are a number of causes. One is the formation of a scar of a scar, of scarring tissue that does not allow nerves to reconnect. But second, and not less important, is the fact that nerves within the central nervous system do not have the ability to regrow. So it's both intrinsic to the nerves and the neurons in the spinal cord and in the brain, and extrinsic to them that causes them not to regrow and reconnect.
Scientists have been kind of attacking.
In recent years, there have been a handful of exciting results involving people with paraplegia, with individuals regaining some control and movement below the site of their injuries through a variety of different techniques. Jeff Marquis, who you heard at the beginning of this episode, was part of a recent trial which used an array of electrodes to stimulate the bottom of his spine, reawakening his ability to move his legs. We'll hear more about that in a moment. But first, producer Jeff asked Simone to describe some of these different approaches that are showing promise in helping those who have sustained these life-changing injuries get back on their feet.
One, which has become quite popular lately, is to use stem cells to replace the lost cells following a spinal cord injury and to favor the lost connectivity by patching new cells implanted into the spinal cord.
Where do the stem cells come from?
Stem cells come from embryonic stem cells, human embryonic stem cells, whenever this is allowed in some countries and states within the US, this is allowed. Or they can come from small skin biopsies of the skin, and the skin cells from patients or volunteers can then be differentiated in culture into neurons or young neurons, and that these are then transplanted into the spinal cord. These are the two main sources that have some potential for future clinical impact.
So that's stem cells. What's the second broad approach?
The second broad approach has to do with the strategies that aim to enhance the intrinsic capacity of injured nerves to regenerate by, for example, delivering drugs or gene therapy into neurons, into the spinal cord or the brain where they originate from, and try to enhance the regenerative ability. A complementary approach to this is to inhibit the glial scar, so the scarring tissue. And inhibiting the scarring tissue, potentially together with enhancing the ability of neurons to regenerate, could be a good combinatorial approach to promote regrowth and connectivity.
And so what's the third strategy?
Yeah, the third strategy takes advantage, if you will, from the development of technologies that allow to modulate the activity of the nerves. And modulating the activity has been done in different ways. For example, electrically stimulating the spinal cord from outside, or using special neurorehabilitation strategies, and or using robotics that include, for example, the use of exoskeleton. There are this basically kind of engineered, if you will, vest that favor movement, and partially they can also receive feedback in terms of decoding some activity, internal activity, and they decode the activity and they try to instruct it to promote some kind of movement.
Which of those strategies is showing the most promise? Is there a cure for spinal cord injury?
Yeah. Let's say that the three strategies can be complementary, and I think the future will probably have room for the combination of these strategies. However, at present, the most impactful and also visually compelling strategies are the ones that relate to modulating neuronal activity via electrical stimulation, specific neurorehabilitation programs. The big advantage of these strategies is that from not moving a limb or from not moving a hand, it's possible to elicit some movement. However, very primitive level of control. Therefore, while these strategies are quite impactful these days and exciting to some patients, I doubt that by themselves will be sufficient to find the final solution for these patients. Indeed, the final solution can be found only once we are able to reconnect disrupted connections from within or also from outside. But in some way, we need to rewire the system, and we are not there yet.
You're listening to The Guardian Science Weekly. After the break, we'll hear about a recent trial which managed to help a small group of paraplegic individuals walk again, including Jeff Markey.
Just being able to like feel the body weight back on my feet and get that feedback from the ground is kind of something I've missed. I used to run a lot and found that pretty therapeutic, and it's nice to just like get a taste of that back. For my mental health, it's huge.
You'll hear more from Jeff and the researcher who worked with him in just a moment.
In this week's books podcast, we discuss race and identity with the philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah and ravens. Yes, that's right. Those big black birds that are held so sacred in British folklore that it's believed the nation will fall if they ever forsake the Tower of London. So raven master Chris Scaife has a big job on his hands. Meet them both, or should that be all, on the Guardian Books podcast.
Welcome back. Before the break, we heard about the difficulties in repairing spinal cord injuries and how the cells that make up the central nervous system don't heal like some of our body's other tissues. But recently, in a groundbreaking study at the Kentucky Spinal Cord Injury Research Center, part of the University of Louisville, four patients managed to move their legs, and some even walked unassisted, after they had electrodes implanted into their lower back. This process, known as epidural stimulation, seems to tap into the faint signals still crossing the site of the injury, which are sent by the brain. The work was co-authored by Dr. Claudia Angeli, and I got her on the line. Can you tell me a little bit about the patients that were involved, first of all? What sort of injuries are we talking about here?
Yes, the patients that we recruited for this particular study were classified with a motor complete spinal cord injury, meaning that following their injury, they had absolutely no movement below the level of injury. Two of them had no sensation below the level of injury, and two of them had some impaired sensation below the level of injuries. But all of them were motor complete, meaning that they had no ability to move their legs.
So the technique which you've used to help these patients to take steps again, let's talk a little about that. So that involves implanting some electrodes sort of in the lower back, and this is below where the injury is, so the injury is sort of further up the spinal cord, and then you implant these electrodes in the lower back. Now talk me through the sort of theory behind this. What are those electrodes doing? This isn't about sort of externally controlling someone, is it?
No, it's not. The idea of implanting the electrode in the lower spinal cord is that that's where the circuits for locomotion and walking are located in the spinal cord. So that's why we target that area. And we're not inducing or generating the movement. We are allowing the spinal cord to integrate the signals that it used to have before the injury, and it used to know how to integrate those signals into movement. We're doing the same thing with the electrode, just by making the spinal cord more aware that those signals are still coming in, and now it's relearning to integrate and do what it used to do before the injury.
So if I've understood this correctly, it sounds like there are still some signals coming from the brain down the spinal cord towards the leg saying, you know, I want to move my legs. But the problem is that with these injuries, not much of that signal is getting through, and certainly not enough to actually generate movement if you don't have these electrodes there. But when you have these electrodes there and turned on, they somehow boost that signal or make it easier f- for that signal to be heard. Is that right?
That is exactly correct. The electrical stimulation that we're using is pretty much allowing the spinal cord to now hear those signals that are coming in and generating the movement, and in this case, developing it all the way to walking.
Let's talk a little bit about how this therapy has worked. So it has to be used in conjunction with physiotherapy, is that right? You can't just insert these electrodes, do an operation, insert them, turn them on, and hey presto. It's there's a lot more to it than that, isn't there?
Yes. The ability of the spinal cord to relearn at complex tasks such as walking takes time. We are able to see movement right away. So when we turn the stimulation on and we ask the individuals to move their toes or move their legs, that actually happens very early without training or therapy. But walking and standing are tasks that are a lot more complex and require a lot more coordination between different muscles and different parts of the leg. So that actually takes training, and the spinal cord has to relearn how to integrate all the signals to be able to generate the movement that we're looking for.
And this can take months, right? I mean, it can take a very long time to do that retraining.
Yes, absolutely. It's a long process. Our research per se, we require them to be here for a minimum of a year. So it is a very long process for them. But it's also rewarding in the sense that you actually see the little things happen. So the ability to move, to wiggle their toes, to integrate toe up through the step, and then being able to see how all those building blocks come together into developing a full step and being able to translate that into overground walking.
So yes, some of the individuals were... There were four participants in Dr. Anjali's study, and two of them managed to regain their ability to walk with a metal walker or similar tool. One of them was even discharged home. The other two participants also made progress, including being able to stand independently with a walker and improve their sitting posture. But why did some participants fare better than others?
We found, and this is something again that we need to investigate in much more detail, the two individuals that did not translate to overground walking were the ones that did not have sensory information. So they were sensory complete, meaning that had no sensation below the level of injury. The big question now was the having some sensory information below the level of injury help with walking, or does it not matter? And it's just a matter of maybe there wasn't enough training for those individuals to be able to progress any farther.
That's interesting, because another group has also been working on this, and they released research at the same time. This was just with one individual, but I believe that individual didn't have any sensation below the level of the injury, and they too were able to take steps in the end.
Right, and we are excited to see that an independent group is getting very similar results. So most of the evidence might be showing that sensation does not really matter, but every injury is different, every individual is different. So I think the training side, how many training sessions you need, how long do you need to do this before you get walking again, it's going to vary. And that's why we need to do this research in a larger number of individuals to see, okay, what's the minimum time that we need for this to be something that can be translated into the home and community.
So very promising results for the four individuals in this small trial. But as Dr. Anjali says, bigger trials are needed to get more robust results, on how useful this epidural stimulation technique could be more widely for those with spinal cord injuries. But it certainly seems to have made a big difference to Jeff. I wanted to hear from him about his personal experiences of going through the trial, training 5 days a week, and getting to grips with his implant.
Yeah, so going from when I first got injured, they're not optimistic at all about me being independent in a wheelchair, much less independently stepping or standing. And to go from just not really being a possibility to being possible again, it was just huge. I'm not real good at conveying how what a ray of sunshine that was, but it definitely was. I mean, I still got a ways to go before I can walk on my own, without someone there kind of to catch me if I fall, so to speak, literally. So I'm working on that, sort of trying to see what else this thing can do is what I'm working on right now.
It's almost impossible to comprehend how tough it must be to start learning to control your legs all over again after such an injury. But hearing Jeff's story makes it clear that even regaining limited movement can have a huge personal impact. I wanted to get a sense of how the results were received by the wider research community. Back to Simone Di Giovanni, the neurologist from Imperial College London, who we heard from earlier.
I think it was a very interesting observation to see that some of these patients do have an improvement in the so-called ASIA score, which has specific clinical scores that analyze movement and sensory function in these patients. Therefore, I think it is an exciting field, but it does need to be developed. In one way, we need more controlled and larger studies so that we don't make this a strategy that might be tailored just to a few patients, but to most patients. And the other general thought I have is similar to what I was saying earlier. I think that these strategies alone will not be able to lead to conclusive repair and recovery in these patients, because ultimately we need to work on enhancing reconnectivity, which is still lost in these patients.
Do these trials suffer from any sort of general problems then about how the people are selected? Or,
well, the selection of patients is, let's say that every study that has just a few patients can suffer from this kind of issue. They try, for example, in this paper to have patients with some different level of impairment and incomplete, more or less incomplete or complete lesions. But it is mainly in the numbers that the problem lies. Because if you have large randomized trials, and then this issue does not exist. So there is also potentially, but I don't know the specific of these studies, but there's potentially an issue with patients who are more prone to undergo specific programs, rehabilitation program, electrical simulations versus others. So this might create some kind of bias, in particular when numbers are low. And maybe a last thought on this that I would like to share is the fact that while it is a great achievement to be able to enhance some movement in a limb, for example, that didn't have any movement beforehand, the gap to be filled from this kind of movement that we have observed to a fully controlled and fine-tuned movement that will be very important to further enhance the quality of life of this patient is still a big gap to fill. And while I'm optimistic, it's very difficult to give a timeline. And therefore, these studies are exciting, but should not send the wrong message that we found a cure for spinal cord injury, or that we are very close to it.
Despite this success, then, we need to be cautious about extrapolating the results of this small trial and assuming that the technique will offer benefits for all those with paraplegia, or even that it's necessarily the best option. But this epidural stimulation has clearly been a game changer for Jeff and some of his co-participants. Across the research community, it feels like there's room for optimism, with different angles of attack in the field and new results emerging that are changing the lives of those with paraplegia. Special thanks this week to Jeff Marquis, Claudia Angeli, and Simone DiGiovanni for contributing to the show. If you want to find out more, check out the links in the episode's description on the Guardian website. And if you want to get in touch with the Science Weekly team, drop us a line at scienceweekly@theguardian.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly. For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.